I'm feeling happy, I can't disappear it. And if I'm feeling angry, I can't disappear it. The only way I can transform it is to accept it, is to breathe into it, and actually feel it.
That was Philip Cox-Hind, and you're listening to episode 290 of the Building Psychological Strength podcast, where we uncover the information, tools, and techniques to turn our mind into our most valuable asset.
The courage to face fears with persistence.
Being able to be present enough in this moment to choose my response thoughtfully.
We have the strength to bend to life stressors, to bend to adversity without snapping, without breaking.
There are only six things that contribute to our quality of life, and they are all experiences.
In every moment, we are deciding who we want to be and how we want to live our lives.
Noticing what your brain is doing and then being able to make choices.
Mobilize the things that we know lift us up.
Hello, hello. Welcome back to the Building Psychological Strength podcast. My name is April and I'm your host. Happy Wednesday, friends. You've made it to the middle of the week. That's exciting. And I'm so glad you're here. I'm absolutely thrilled that you are taking time out of your busy week because, wow, do we know that we are all extremely busy these days. Taking time out of your busy week to be here, to learn, and to apply what you're learning in this podcast into your own life so that you can start to see the transformation and the change that is possible if you work on yourself, if you cultivate a set of skills that allows your mind to work in your favor rather than it being a big barrier for you across each and every facet of your life. Thank you for being here. Thank you for choosing yourself. Thank you for taking this time to devote to such an impactful and important set of skills. On that note, before I dive into this week's guest, who is such an incredible expert in it, everything that I just mentioned, I want to take a quick pause, say thank you for this incredible review that was recently left on iTunes. It relates so much to what we're going to be talking about today. It says, April brings curiosity and clarity to every conversation, which allows her to distill complex psychological constructs into accessible and actionable ideas. Make sure this podcast is part of your regular listening. Thank you, thank you, thank you to the incredible listener who left that review. And in particular, what I loved about the review is this notion of distilling complex constructs or things that can feel a bit vaporous to us when we talk about them. Things like emotional intelligence and cognitive load and decision fatigue and human values and all of that. How do we take those constructs, but then create actionable things that we can do about them, connect them to our daily lives and how we might take action in a different way and use them to improve our day-to-day life experience. That is absolutely why I'm here. And I'm so thankful to this listener for pointing that out in that review. So thank you so much. If you haven't yet rated and reviewed the podcast, please head over to iTunes or wherever it is that you listen to podcasts, drop us a rating and a review. You have no idea how much it means both to the reach of the podcast, you know, those platforms, they see how many ratings and reviews you get and they push you out to more people, the more you get. So I am literally grateful for each and every one that we get. But also, it helps me understand what you're taking away from this podcast so that I can give you more of that. It helps me understand what the podcast has meant to you from your experience. And that's ultimately why I'm here. Okay, let's talk about this week's guest. It is so thrilling to me when someone out in the world, in the UK in this case, finds the podcast, sees the value in it, and recognizes that their expertise could contribute to what we're all doing here in this community. And that's what happened with this week's guest. So Philip Cox-Hind is this week's guest, and he is an expert behavioral change facilitator. So what the heck does that mean? Philip has worked with some of the world's biggest companies, companies like Pfizer and Microsoft. We're talking giant companies, in order to help typically high-level executives make changes and live and lead in a more effective way. He uses a variety of skills. Some of them came from his time as a facilitator of large personal development conferences, but also skills that he's taken away from his Vipassana meditation practice. We talk in this podcast about specifically happiness versus satisfaction. We have a really deep conversation about that, and you're not going to want to miss the insight there. We also talk about the importance of the way that we listen and ask questions when we're in interpersonal relationships as a method of developing intimacy. We talk about the importance of mindfulness throughout all of that, and really what the cultivation of this set of skills, and by this I mean psych strength. I mean, really, we're talking about very similar things here, about how when we cultivate those psych strength skills, specifically our own ability to recognize our emotional landscape throughout the day as it's changing and morphing and responding to our environment, when we cultivate that, we create this ability to have what we refer to in this episode as a psychological pause, some spaciousness, some space between the incoming information, stimuli, context, challenge, adversity, whatever it is that life is handing us, space between that and our response. Space that allows us to pause, to feel like we don't immediately need to react, but to deliberate and to think about what the intentional action that we want to take is. Even in some of the most difficult circumstances, being able to tolerate being in an uncomfortable situation, pause and determine how you want to move forward. It's such a powerful conversation. I'm absolutely thrilled that Philip reached out, and I know that you're going to come out of this conversation with some practical tips for how you can develop this set of skills for yourself and apply it to a number of facets of your life. So please enjoy this conversation with Philip Cox Hind. Philip, I am so excited to have you here today because we're going to be talking about a topic or a set of topics, I believe, that I know are going to benefit this audience greatly. And I know that you have some incredible expertise behind. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure.
We're actually speaking to each other at very different contexts. I'm sitting here at, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, bright sunny day in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And you are where?
About 40 miles west of London in the UK, and it's 7:15 after a lovely, warm summer day. Yeah.
Nice. Well, good evening. Good day to me. And here we are. I'm really excited to dive in because when you reached out about being on the podcast, I was immediately struck by the concrete usefulness of the work that you do. I mean, you focus on some things that can sometimes feel very conceptual and almost out of touch with how we would apply them to our lives. But I love the way that you frame up your work because I could immediately see how it would be applicable to this audience. So I'm excited to dive in. But before we do that, can you tell us just a little bit about you? Because your professional background is really interesting, and the way that you have really gotten this work across the globe to different companies, et cetera. It's really exciting. So can you give us a little bit of a tour of your background?
Sure. I left school at 15 with no qualifications. I'm dyslexic. It was just about understood what dyslexia was in those days. I'm nearly 65 now, so it gives some context of when I left school. And I was always fascinated in people, even when I was a kid. So I tried a few dead-end jobs and then went for the profession I really wanted, which is to be an actor. So I went to drama college for 3 years and I was a professional actor, mainly film and television for about 10, 11 years. It didn't really feel right. It felt like I was partly in those days in for the fame and the fortune, which didn't really happen. But I was fascinated by people still. And I did a personal development course which is an offshoot, a UK offshoot of EST, which is now Landmark Forum, in the mid-80s. And it life changed me. I started to reflect on my own life, my own thoughts, my own emotions, my own being in a way I'd never thought before. And the word that really stuck with me, which is the central tenet of that work, was responsibility. And they phrased it in the terms of you are able to respond to your life. Responsibility. And I made friends with one of the facilitators for the 6 months afterwards. And she said, you're really interested in this stuff, aren't you? And I said, yeah. She said, well, leave acting, join us, and we'll train you.
Interesting.
So I became one of only three facilitators to lead this particular workshop, which was 5 days long over a Friday and two weekends. And I stayed for a couple of years. I left. I worked with some fascinating people. I worked with a guy called John Grinder, who formulated NLP. With his partner, Richard Bandler, Neuro-Linguistic Programming, for those who haven't heard that acronym. Did work with him, did work with various other people, and eventually formed my own seminar, which I ran to the public for 3 or 4 years. And that seminar was all about the personal understanding I'd picked up on, but also interpersonal communication. I'd seen so many people attend workshops as a facilitator. And the phrase was, they left the seminar room not being able to chew gum and cross the road at the same time. Mm-hmm. What's the practical application of this stuff?
100%.
And it was through that course called the Communication Seminar to the Public that a couple of delegates came up to me afterwards and said, this has been fantastic for me to learn about myself, but also interpersonal communication. Have you ever thought of taking it into business? This would be brilliant in my company. Well, he was this ex-actor in his early 30s, didn't own a suit. And so I was introduced to a computer company, and the CEO of that company introduced me to the VP of a little software company in the UK called Microsoft. So I worked with them for 18 months in the 90s.
No big deal.
And then I got referred to companies like Pfizer. I was the lead consultant on the Viagra project, for instance, which was fascinating for all kinds of reasons. But what I learned there was, again, practical application.
Yeah.
How could I take the esoteric, some would say, the kind of jargonistic stuff about self-discovery and apply it to a business?
Right.
And that's what I really learned. And I've been working both with companies and with individuals on that very topic of self-understanding and practical application.
I love it. And that's such a great segue, because your work, when you reached out, I was so struck by the way that you categorize the work that you do, because it's so comprehensive. And you're right, people leave out important components that I see in your work. So as a high level, it looks like your work really falls into these three categories. One, which is represented by I, so personal and self-management. We've got you, which is interpersonal communications. And then we've got we, which is fulfilling relationships. And that's so key, because in Peak Mind, when we think about psych strength, there's an aspect, there's 7 elements that we talk about, but one of those elements is the self. It's our own identity, our relationship with ourself, the care and feeding of our own both physical and mental well-being.
Yeah.
But relationships are a huge part of it, because fostering close relationships and being able to be solidly in relationship with other people, we know what a big component of mental well-being that is. And I love that that is part of your work. I'm hoping we can kind of maybe hop through these three, because you've got a lot underneath the covers of all of them, but there are some pieces in these that we haven't covered before that I would love to dive into, given it is so much in your area of expertise.
Sure.
Are you game?
Very game.
Good. Okay. So let's start with I and personal self-management. You have a unique perspective on happiness. We all talk about wanting to be happy as though that is the end all be all goal of our lives, but you contrast happiness with satisfaction. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I actually quote the woman I learned to facilitate from back in the 80s. She used to do a great thing when she was talking about the contrasts of life. And she was quite dramatic. She went up to somebody on the front row and held her hand out and moved her hand closer and closer and closer to the person sitting on the front row until they couldn't see anything other than her hand. And she kept saying, "What do you see?" "Well, I see the hand and I see the room and I see your face." And the closer she got, the person said, "Well, I can't see your face anymore, but I can see the room and I can see your hand." And then eventually, when a hand was right in front of her, she said, "What can you see? I can only see hand." Mm. I said, "Would you?" She said, "Would you know it was hand if that's all you'd ever known?"
Mm.
And we only know happiness because it's contrasted with pain and upset and anger and frustration and all of the other things that are part of being human. Mm-hmm. And so I know that when I am attempting something that might be difficult, I mean, before I've been interviewed lots of times, I always feel a mixture of, I call it N and E, nervous and excited.
Nice.
Because my body is going into, want to perform, want to be real, want to be true, want to do a good job. You know, my little voice inside my head's purring away there. And do I feel happy? It's a strange term. I feel alive.
Yeah.
And if I do a good job and it feels as though we've created something worthwhile, I will feel satisfied. But along the route to get to an end point, to be satisfied in a relationship, satisfied with a piece of work, satisfied with decorating a room, I will go through a whole range of emotions in order to get there. So for me, I'm not against happiness. I love feeling happy. It's wonderful. I'm a Vipassana meditator. I've been doing that meditation for 20-odd years. And at the end of every session, the teacher always says, "May all beings be happy."
Mm.
And for me, happiness is content with whatever I feel, being satisfied with pain to an extent, because the dynamics of emotion, I don't know if you want me to go into this depth, but I'm just kind of feeling I'm going to go.
I love it. Yeah, so, let's do it.
So when I think back to my poor schooling, but I do remember some basics of physics, Newton famously said the three things about energy and the way that we understand energy. So one is you can't disappear energy. You can only transform it from one state to another.
Right.
So why am I mentioning energy like electricity or gravity or whatever? Because the same dynamic, if we think about it, applies to emotion. I'm feeling happy, I can't disappear it. And if I'm feeling angry, I can't disappear it. The only way I can transform it is to accept it, is to breathe into it, actually feel it. There's so much rubbish, use a stronger word, but we've been recorded. So much rubbish talked about feeling enlightened and feeling great. And yeah, but that isn't the goal. The goal is to feel comfortable, at peace, happy, if you like, satisfied with whatever I'm feeling.
That
and
equanimity.
When I allow, when I allow the emotion to go through me, it exits quicker. And the other dynamic, if people are wondering, what are the other two? Well, one is whatever you resist persists with equal and opposite force. So the amount of energy it takes me to suppress being angry is equal and opposite to the anger. It's tiring as hell.
Yes.
And the third one, energy will take the path of least resistance. So if I attempt to block what I'm feeling, it'll come out some other way. Now, that might be something I'm just prepared to sit with. That might be my way of dealing with it. But it doesn't really work when you come to contact with you, as in interpersonal communication, or we, as in relationships, because if I can't tell the emotional truth to someone I'm talking to or someone in a relationship with, then I've got big problems.
Yeah.
So it's learning ways to feel comfortable with the discomfort of emotional roller coasters, which might lead to a form of happiness in that I feel peaceful and content on a good day with whatever I'm feeling. So that's my distinction between happiness and satisfaction.
I love that so much. And there's so much backing for everything you've said around the difference between accepting the emotional state that we have, which is just acknowledging what it is. We're not saying we like it. We're not saying we want more of it, especially in the case of pain or discomfort of some sort. But being able to acknowledge that it's there in a non-judgmental way without fighting against it and trying to ignore or repress or wrestle with it is such a more effective way of moving through, especially a difficult emotion, and making sure, and this is the key for folks listening to this, your second point about an equal and opposite force, you know, against that anger, against that sadness, that guilt, whatever it is. We find that in amazingly corroborated research in psychology, that the more we push against those negative feelings over the long term, the stronger they become.
Yeah.
But if we can sit with them, as you're suggesting, and be more accepting, learn ways to be with them without being taken by them, and there's a whole slew of things around that, we in the long run can develop a more peaceful relationship with our emotions. And I just love that distinction you made.
We can. And I think the other thing that is really important for me to say, because I'm dyslexic, because I don't read very much. I mean, I've written two books, amazingly, but I dictated them because I don't read. I use a book consultant to help me structure it all. But the key for me isn't about intellectually learning that, because what I've just said, a lot of people go, yeah, I get that. And then they leave the room and they stub their foot and then they blame the door because that's human nature. So the thing I'm very big on is to learn disciplines, to learn. So discipline comes from the word disciple, which is to follow, which is to follow. You know, I've been into fitness and ultra running and all kinds of crazy things most of my life. And I've never looked forward to putting my running shoes on. Never. But I know that unless I follow a discipline of a training and repeat it, you don't go to a gym for 10 days and say, I want to get really fit. And at the end of it, you leave and you go, great, I'm fit now. And you never go back to the gym.
Good to go.
And so the discipline of training your mind to deal with a level of discomfort, emotional discomfort, and learning the discernment between discomfort that's trying to tell me something useful and emotion that's just part of my defense mechanism. So I think we probably all know the simple thing of as soon as we come into contact with any of the senses, touch, taste, sight, hearing, smell, this one out. The thing I learned with Vipassana, this Buddhist form of meditation, is they talk about the sixth sense door. Are you familiar with that, April?
A bit. I've only practiced a little bit of Vipassana, other forms of meditation, but please go there.
It's a concept that's universal. I've read research that estimates the amount of thoughts we have per day is somewhere between 20 and 50,000.
So many.
And one thing I do with companies I work with or individuals is I'll get them to close their eyes. And I'm talking about this emotional dynamics of resistance, persistence, and feeling and allowing yourself to feel it. Close your eyes, bring to mind a scary experience. And then rather than noting it as fear, as you raise your finger if you've thought of something. Okay, you can do this with me if you're listening. Close your eyes, think about a scary experience. And then notice what's happening to your heartbeat. What's happening to your breathing? Might be very subtle. What's happening to your musculature? You know, is it tension anywhere? Sweat response. These are micro signals that a simple thought is affecting your body. Mm-hmm. It's producing this fight or flight chemical, which I'm sure most people have heard of adrenaline, and it keeps us safe. So when I cross the road outside my house and a big red bus comes around the corner, I really want that chemical because it shoots through my body and enables me to jump out of the way. But if somebody shouts at me in a crowd, you know, you're a stupid man. And again, I feel something in my body, but then I can discern between the fear that I actually do need to do something about and the F-E-A-R false evidence appearing real.
Yes.
And through practicing being in levels of discomfort, as weird as that sounds, we can start to practice through a discipline what it's like to increase our ability to discern. I just want to do a quick little thing with you. Do you know the hand clasp thing?
No.
Oh, right. So if you're listening, just clasp your hands together. Whatever way you do, interlock your fingers. Most of us tend to intrinsically have our one thumb on top of the other. So which thumb have you got on top of the other, April?
My left thumb.
Your left. And I've got my left over as well. So people might be thinking, oh, what does this mean? Wow, it's very deep and meaningful. So psychologists have actually studied this. So I'd start with it. Are you left-handed or right-handed?
Right-handed.
Okay, that's interesting. So if you're wondering whether we do it with our left thumb on top or right thumb on top, correlating to left or brain, right brain hemisphere, I'm left-handed and I've got my left thumb on top. So it's probably not to do with that. So psychologists have noticed, put children in a room, because it starts very early on, and they observe what they call resting behaviors. What do we do with our arms, our legs, our hands when we're watching TV, or, you know, our brains are engaged, but our bodies don't need to be. And we do things, you know, we fold our arms, we do. And then notice these children, to start with, would clasp their hands in different ways, randomly, over a period of days or weeks when they've learned they can do that. But then they start doing it more one way than the other. And it's purely down to neuronal connection. So the little electrodes in our brains that connect to something, to a response. April, that's a word you're very familiar with. There's a neuronal pathway somewhere in your brain.
Yes.
That's a groove under electron microscope to the stimulus response of April.
Yes.
And likewise, when you put your hands together the way you do it, that's the way you do it. Now clasp your hands the other way around. So if you've still got your hands together listening, take your hands apart and intertwine different fingers with a different thumb on top. Does that feel as natural or as comfortable?
No, not at all.
Ah. So if you can just stay with that for a second, because what you're feeling there is discomfort real time, but it don't mean nothing.
Yeah.
In terms of, there's no tiger going to get you. But your brain is saying, I want to support you. The Neanderthal part, the monkey brain, is saying, I want to support you. I'm going to look out for you. Anything that looks, feels, sounds out of the ordinary, I'm going to shoot a bit of adrenaline around just in case there's a tiger around the corner.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that if you sat with your hands clasped like this, the other way around, for 10 minutes straight is the minimum, they reckon, for about 28 days straight, this will feel as comfortable as the other way around. And likewise, the more we get practice through meditation or through, there's a whole range of things to do it in feeling discomfort, but the discomfort actually isn't going to destroy us. It's just discomfort that we feel because we want to feel happy all the time. Then that discipline teaches us to discern the difference between the two and also become more comfortable with the uncomfortable.
I love that. I love that so much. That's one of the skills that I think I learned first as I was on this journey of applying everything that I learned in graduate school and in the field to my own life, is this notion of, oh my gosh, our quote unquote comfort zone, meaning the stuff that we're just accustomed to doing versus the stuff we're not, it can move.
Yeah.
We can impact the barriers of it. And absolutely. I love that you started with something that seems so small, right? If just clasping your hands in the opposite way is enough to register a response in your mind that says, wait, that's not right. Imagine how something slightly more material or something increasingly more material registers. Yeah. We notice the most subtle of things. So it's not surprising that these large changes, like the year we've all been through with COVID, or
absolutely,
major changes in our jobs or relationships, register these huge waves in terms of how we're feeling and how we're interacting with the world.
Completely. When I mentioned the word responsibility, ability to respond earlier. And I think it's important that we give ourselves a break and understanding the kind of sequence that leads up to being able to respond.
Yeah.
And the first part of that sequence for me is I am a reactive creature. I am reactive. You know, you push me, I want to push you back. That's my reaction.
Yes.
I can be in as lightened as hell. But if I'm not in a good mood or a good place, I'm going to be reactive.
Yeah.
But then the next point is I do have reflective consciousness. I can notice my reaction. And then I can respond. Then I can probably do something different. I was a bit short because I was a bit tired, and there was a pushback on the radio from the government that the lockdown restrictions we're having here weren't going to be eased when we thought they were. So there's a bunch of stuff, and I hadn't slept that well that night, and blah, 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 blah. And I went to my coffee house in town a couple of weeks ago, and a guy asked me to step outside when it was raining, and I've been vaccinated, and I've got a card to say I've been vaccinated, and there's no one else in the cafe. And I just said, oh, that's a bit silly, isn't it? And a real tone in my voice. And he said, well, those are the rules. So I felt very righteous, and I got my coffee and I walked back. And then the more I reflected on it, it didn't take me that long. So that didn't feel right. Mm-hmm. He was only doing his job. And what's mm-hmm. it like to be a barista? What's it like to have a mask on 10 hours a day? So I thought, okay, Philip, you've reflected on it. What can you do about it? Where's your ability to respond? So I went back and said, I want to offer you something. He said, what? He looked at me a bit askant. You know, what's this crazy guy come back?
Yeah, right.
I said, I want to offer you an apology if you're prepared to hear it. And he said, yeah. And his eyes glistened. He said, thank you. You've made my day. So
that's awesome.
It's not clever. We all do stuff that sometimes we think about afterwards. We could have done it better. We could have done it differently. And it's not about getting it right. I remember creating a leadership development program for Pfizer, for the leadership team at Pfizer. And I was delivering this over many, many months to the top people in Pfizer UK. And I'd always meet with the delegates in advance. They're going to give up 3 or 4 days of their time, get a chance to meet. And I always feel that it's important as a facilitator for me to self-disclose proportionately to the people I'm working with, but to let them know a bit about me. And I'd not long been going through a divorce, the only divorce. And this guy very astutely said, hang on a moment, you're going to teach us about leadership and interpersonal communication, and you've got a failed marriage. And I took a breath. I didn't react actually that much. I reflected pretty quickly, and I said, actually, my experience, communication and relationships isn't about getting it right. It's about what we have the courage to recognize and do when we get it wrong.
That's good.
And it sounds a bit trite, but I think it is true. You know, there's nowhere else to go if we can't do that. And that's why I feel that, you know, the Techniques for Living, which is the name of the program, that if anyone wants to hear me, we'll say it more at the end of the podcast. But I came up with the title Techniques for Living because for me, it's about living, right? You know, living a full life. But there are techniques that don't have to be dehumanized. But learning the thing with the hand, crossing our hands, being discerning about our emotions, listening to going through that process of breathing, heart rate, musculature, sweat response, every time I have an emotion, get into that habit, you'll hit on the real emotion far more accurately.
Yeah.
Because sometimes I think I'm angry when actually I'm scared or I'm frightened. And unless I go to my body never lies. You know, my body never lies. And so being able to learn certain techniques to become more discerning as an individual puts me in a much better place when I want to start communication with somebody else, interacting.
Yeah, I love that. And that's actually where I wanted to go, because you do so much around interpersonal communication and about how we can be a more effective communicator, particularly when we have to say something that's more difficult to another person. that can be that ability to directly but empathetically speak to another person is not something that we do naturally. Maybe there's individual differences and some people are just naturally better at it than others, but largely people have to work at that. Can you offer some tips and about how, you know, your expertise and the work that you've done can help people more effectively communicate? Because talk about a baseline skill for setting up any relationship for success.
Gosh, it's such a huge subject and it's been a massive part of my work. And I'd summarize it to start with two short phrases. One is deep listening. And the second is open questions. And what I mean by deep listening is there's lots of techniques that I practice and support people with around it. So one of them is for those not being able to see in their podcast, I'm going to hold up an item for April and I'm holding up a pen. So if I was to say at the same time, April, this is a fork, what would you think?
I mean, I would just be confused. Like, no, it isn't. It's a pen.
Yeah, that's right. So confusion, comparison. Yeah.
Yeah.
But the very first thought, and I'll short frame it because of time, the very first thought for you to be able to do the comparison, you're seeing pen, you're hearing a word.
Yeah.
And the very first thing is you create an image or an experience of the thing you can't see.
Yes.
Which is a fork.
Yes.
So what happens in a nanosecond as I'm speaking, there's a repeat inside your head. Particularly when I say something like pink flamingo, which you weren't expecting. Did you hear the echo of pink what? What did you just say? So that, do you remember, going back a while now, do you remember the film Rain Man?
Yes.
With Tom Cruise and Dustin Hoffman. Brilliant, autistic guy played brilliantly by Hoffman. And there's a lovely scene where Tom Cruise has rescued Hoffman from an institution and he's going to sort him out, and they're in a motel room. And Hoffman's reading a book and it's the Yellow Pages. It's a phone directory, effectively. As Cruise gets ready, and then they go out for dinner, and the waitress comes and she's got her name badge on, Julie Smith, Julie Roskowski or something a bit more unusual than Smith. And Hoffman just looks up and says, Julie Smith, 678-9496. That's my phone number. How do you know it? He said, I read it in a book.
Wow.
One of the wonderful things about autism is that one of the aspects, complicated subjects, is they in some cases don't have the ability to filter. Mm-hmm. So in that case, photographic memory, absorbing everything. Now imagine if we tried to live our complex lives like that, it drives us crazy. So what we do is we filter out what we don't think is important. Mm-hmm. Which a lot of the time is fine. But when I really want to hear you, when I really want to honor you, particularly if you're saying things that I find difficult, that create a reaction in me, then if I can slow myself down and consciously repeat the words in my head, I'm doing it now. So even to the point now, I've learned the discipline. If I'm buying something over the phone or somebody needs to get my phone number and I know it backwards, so it's easy to say 07976353295 and then the person on the other side says, what? But if I say it at the speed somebody can consciously double it or to consciously repeat it, 07976353295. Now, that's easy when it's a phone number. But when I say, you said something to me last night that really hurt me, when you're on the receiving end of something like that, it's much more difficult. Mm-hmm. And this isn't a panacea for avoiding arguments. They will happen. But at some point, when the reactivity slows and the reflectiveness kicks in, and I start to ask myself, what can I do about this? Mm. I can blame the other person till the cows come home. Is that a US expression? It is one in the UK. To the cows.
Yeah, we use that.
You know what I mean? I've lived in the States and I've picked up on a few, but I don't know. I'll contribute that one. Yeah, I can blame them forever. Or I can say, so what else can I do? You know, If you're on an argument, great, have a shouting match. Sometimes it blows off steam, fine. But really? So slowing things down, practicing that conscious doubling. And if I'm in a real pickle with somebody, I'll hear them and I'll say, can I just say out loud what I've heard? And I'll repeat back the essence. And it's not like a parrot. It's just like, if you got me? So the point of that is that I said at the beginning, deep listening and asking questions, open questions. I can't ask questions unless I'm being heard. Mm. If we're in a fight, if we're not here, if we're missing each other, you ain't going to listen to my questions.
Right.
Unless you feel heard. So practicing listening, slowing down, breathing in between sentences, and then asking questions that are framed to unpick more of your world, even if it's a world I don't like or understand, rather than questions to make me right. Mm. So when you say you really don't like the way I talk to you, what were the words that particularly hurt you? Or when you said it hurt you, in what way? And or how could I have said a similar thing, the essence of what I was saying, but in a way that was easier to hear? Mm-hmm. So practicing questions, and I use a communication, a conversation cycle. It's based on what we do. It's so simple. When I use it as a handout with people, it goes, is this it? It's got three bits
right.
in it. Ask a question, self-disclosure, and acknowledgement. So every conversation will start with somebody talking about a subject. So I'm talking to you about communication. And to make it more human, I'm putting in my own experience. So I'm talking about I, and times I listen and times I don't listen. And then I would say to you in April, how does that land with you? Mm. What sense does that make? And I'll avoid things like, do you understand it? Because that's yes or no, and I don't know what you're saying yes or no to. So opening, asking open questions, and then you'll come back with what you want to say, and then I'll acknowledge that. And if it's really important, I may even say it back to you. Mm-hmm. And then I might say, well, actually, that leads me onto something else, and then I talk a bit. And you get this three-part conversational cycle, which is, if you go into a bar, a restaurant, overhear conversations that are just flowing, this is what we do. This is what humans do.
Yes.
We say something. When it flows, we say something, we end with a question, they say something and respond, we acknowledge them, and we say something else.
Yes.
And when a communication isn't working, it will be down to one of those three either being missed out or being massively disproportionate to the others. So if I'm just saying questions, if I said to April, do you understand that? And you say, play with me. So
yeah, that makes sense. Yes.
And what do you think of the listening thing, you know, consciously doubling? Does that make sense?
It does make sense. Yes. Yeah.
And can you see how you could apply? You see what I'm doing?
Yeah.
I'm just asking you questions.
Yep. But point by point. Yeah.
Pretty soon it's going to feel like an interrogation. Mm-hmm. And equally, if I just acknowledge you and say, yes, April, I love that point. And when you said this and you said that, yeah, that's great. And then I didn't say anything else. That would feel weird too.
Right.
Or if I just talked about me and
yourself.
The next point and the next point, the next point, the next point. So to get a conversation balanced, it's making conscious that which we naturally do when it goes well, between asking open questions, really listening and acknowledging what we've heard, and then talking about a next point, but from an I perspective.
It's really interesting because if I go back over a lot of what we've talked about, it really hits on this concept that we talk about in Peak Mind called the gap. It's, you know, life circumstances or other people or situations, they happen and we take that in.
Yeah.
We enter the gap, which is where our mind, our interpretation, our filter, all of that is applied before our behavior happens.
Yeah.
And that behavior, without doing a lot of the things that you're talking about, without building psych strength in the way that we talk about, that gap can be almost entirely filled with your mind's reactive tendencies, thoughts, emotions, interpretations of those, the urges it creates, and our behavior becomes so much more reactive.
Yeah.
What you've hit on throughout this conversation that's so powerful that I don't want people to miss is a way to widen that gap, to slow down your urge to either respond, to form a conclusion, to create certainty, and allow yourself to take in more information and be a bit more deliberate. It's that psychological pause, the space that gets created, the lack of urgency. And we're not talking about you're going to sit there for 10 minutes, stone cold quiet in a conversation and make it awkward, but it can be a matter of a second of a pause that psychologically feels like enough space to respond in a way that's more effective. And I just, I love it. I love it.
Thank you. Thank you. I was just going to say that those two examples that we've started on with I, self-awareness of body and emotions, and then practical listening and conversational skills. When I started to learn that those two, it felt like I was suddenly juggling. Mm. I mean, I've got to consciously listen and ask open questions, not closed ones, and get the pace of the conversation equal between question asking, self-disclosure, and acknowledgement, whilst being aware of my breathing and my skeletal muscular constraint. Yeah. Yes. But when I've talked to jugglers and I can't juggle, or I haven't yet learned to put it that way, I talked to a guy in the street in our little market square a couple of years ago who was juggling with fire sticks. And I said, how'd you do that? And he said, very, very slowly. Which is a great
interesting
answer.
Interesting.
He didn't
I
mean he juggled
it
slowly.
Yeah, yeah.
But he said he started juggling with two balls. And then he got mastered that. And then he juggled with three. And then he moved from three balls to batons. And then from three batons to five batons. And then from five batons to lighted fire batons. And of course, it comes back to that whole thing of practicing a discipline, following disciplement of a methodology, which starts with something as simple as clasping our hands differently. Mm-hmm. You talked about creating more pause. Now, that's probably too long, but getting used to this, the discomfort of a pause. Mm-hmm. There's so many things that until you really become aware of that mind-body phenomena, I have a thought and it manifests itself physically.
Yes.
Until I really become aware of that, it's hard to realize just how many things affect my body. So a pause can make me feel unsettled. Listening to someone else and repeating back things I don't agree with can make me feel unsettled. Just feeling emotion can make me feel unsettled. But the more I get used to it, the more the unsettlement decreases, the more I start to have abilities to respond, to do things differently, not just knee-jerk reaction. And then I become more of the master of it rather than it mastering me. On Vipassana, I'd heard about this crazy meditation where you don't talk for 10 days and there's no eye contact and you don't take a notebook and no computers or phones. And a friend of mine had done firewalking and other weird stuff. Told me about it, and I said, that's ridiculous, sounds crazy. And she gave me a flyer on it. This is long before the internet. And I kept this flyer. I couldn't throw it away. So I put it in my filing tray. And every year I clear it out and I put stuff in the trash or file it away. I didn't know what to do with it. Couldn't file it. Anyway, 8 years go past, came through a divorce, decided I was going to do it. And I've done 10 of them now, 10,
wow.
10 days over the last 20 years. And the thing that every time I go, there's a dissertation at the end of the 10 hours of, you meditate for 10 hours a day with breaks, and then there's a dissertation on video at the end. And the guy that brought to the West, a guy called Goenka, he died a few years ago now, talks a lot about the mind-body phenomena. And I did an advanced course a couple of years ago. The only difference is that you get a copy of the sutta that describes Vipassana. Vipassana means to see things as they really are. That's all it means. And it was half of it was in Pali and half of it was English. So there's only 40 pages of script, 80 altogether with the translations. When it came to mind-body phenomena, it wrote it in the English as mind-body phenomena. And I thought, that's interesting. So I, not reading Pali, not knowing how to pronounce, I had a word with the teacher at one point. I said, I'm just fascinated in the sutra. It talks about mind-body phenomena. He said, oh, yeah, because in Pali, there's only one word.
Interesting. They're synonymous.
There is no distinction between what I think and how I feel, because the linkage between chemicals, what issues the chemicals? My brain. Where do I think? My brain. And it's what I got out of meditating, and I still do, is constantly becoming more and more aware of what's going on, not just in my body, but in the energy of the people I'm talking to. Mm-hmm. And getting more comfortable with pauses and slowing it down and all of the things that, like anything else, I've just had to practice.
Yes. I love that so much. We might have to have you back just to talk about meditation. We talk about mindfulness a lot. And sometimes we talk about mindfulness outside of the context of meditation because there's a lot more to it than simply meditation. But meditation itself has so many benefits that I think we're going to have you back to just dive into that topic in particular. As we're wrapping up, I'm curious with everything that you've shared with us, how you would define psychological strength.
The word that the single word that comes to mind, which I've mentioned a couple of times, is discernment. Discernment. So my psychological strength is my ability, which hopefully will always increase until I die, to discern between what's real and what isn't. Because so much, everything I feel is real on one level. But going back to the acronym of false evidence appearing real, if I'm terrified of looking stupid, if I'm really, really angry because a lover has left me, those are real feelings. But will they kill me physically? Will I spontaneously combust? Will I get a broken leg because of it directly? No. And so I think psychological strength, and another word that's become very popular in the last year with the pandemic is resilience. I've been asked to do so many workshops on emotional resilience. And a lot of people are asking me to come up with, you know, how do I avoid feeling stressed? How do I avoid feeling down? How do I avoid feeling lonely? And sometimes I'll playfully say, what do you want to avoid it for? And secondly, I don't know how to do that. So I think psychological strength comes from that set of muscles, really. Relating it to our physical strength, going back to the gym or running. You know, we only get strong by practicing with a discipline. And I think practicing the discernment of what am I feeling right now? If I can check in with myself five times a day with, just stop myself. Sometimes I've said to people, set five alarms on your phone. And if it goes off, if you have to do it a few minutes later because you're in the middle of a call or you're doing, but just as a reminder, at that point, when you've got the time to do it, as close to that alarm as possible, close your eyes and just go, what's happening right now? What's happening to my breathing? What's happening to my heart rate? What's happening to my musculature? What's happening to my response? And what emotion do those physical symptoms add up to? What am I feeling right now? And the next thing is, and will I give myself permission to feel it, not avoid it? And I think the discernment of working out what's real, what isn't in that context, and practicing the discipline of going with it. There's so much stuff talked about. Go with the flow, feel it anyway. I mean, you know, Nike did well with feel the pain and do it anyway. Well, that's Buddhism in a phrase.
Totally.
To an extent. Yep. But it's so easy to say these sound bites. There's no easy way around absorbing them unless we practice them.
I totally agree. I could not agree more. Where can people find out more about you, about your program, about everything that you have to offer? Where can we find you online?
So if you look at my site, techniquesforlivingoneword.com, or follow me on Instagram, Techniques for Living, then you'll find out more about the programs that we're developing, which we're going to produce a whole suite of courses on all of the components of I, all of the components of you, and the commandments of we, which ran out of time because I probably talked too much.
That's okay. I was too excited about what you were saying, so I didn't want to get you up.
No, it's lovely. Thank you. So techniquesforliving.com. And if you wanted to read more about the stuff I've put in my book, Mindfulness and the Art of Change by Choice, it's on Amazon.
Amazing. I'll make sure we link up to both of those links in the show or in your show notes page and in this episode description. So if you're listening to this right now, you're interested in learning more, you should be able to just swipe up on whatever device you're on, click on those links and learn more. Philip, this has been fantastic. I feel like you have summed up some of the most foundational skills that we want people to have that ripple over into literally every area of their life. If we can apply these practices, these disciplines that you've talked about in every area of our life, it fundamentally changes our experience. And so I appreciate you being with us today for sharing your expertise and helping us apply what can feel very conceptual to realistic situations that we all experience. So thank you so much.
It's been a real pleasure.
It's a simple fact that nearly everyone in the world could benefit from building psychological strength, but not everyone will put in the time and effort to do so. But today you did. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Building Psychological Strength. Now, if you're interested in building the mental toughness, confidence, and resilience you need to thrive through life's ups and downs, visit us at www.peakmindpsychology.com. Also, if there's someone in your life who could benefit from this episode, please share it with them. And if you yourself found this episode valuable, meaning if you took away even one insight that you can use to build psychological strength in your own life, we would so appreciate it if you would drop us a rating and a review on iTunes. The thing is, the more ratings and reviews we have, the easier it is to get this powerful and important content out to the people who need to hear it. Remember, your mind can be your most valuable asset or your biggest liability, and you get to choose. So choose wisely, my friend, and I'll see you next time on Building Psychological Strength.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.